Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday. It's the 18th of August. A pleasure to have you here as always. We always, just the idea. We can't see you. We don't know what you're doing. It's probably best. But the idea that you're out there and you're with us is just very comforting, just to know that you're there. And we appreciate it. And we love you very much. And we thank you for being with us to try to figure out what's going on in our world. We will do so with a wonderful panel this morning. If you'd like to be a part of the discussion, all you have to do is write in. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you. We are going to be talking about the Democratic National Convention. We're going to be talking about COVID. We're going to be talking about the hearing on the post office, as well as what's going on. So a lot to talk about today, and we welcome your thoughts. So let us go and introduce the group, and we will get started. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm here. I'm ready to rock and roll.
Excellent. We will rock and roll in just a moment. Let me also introduce former Times Union Associate Editor. We'll interview him some other time. Mike Spain is here. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Joe. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. And Rosemary Armeo joins us, investigative journalist, UAlbany adjunct professor. How are things, Rosemary? Hello, Rosemary. There we go.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can. How you doing?
Oh, good. That's excellent.
Yeah. All right. How is getting ready to be an adjunct?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm a little bit behind on that. It just is so different when you don't have students sitting in front of you. It's just yet another Zoom session. Oh, my goodness.
It's very weird. Very, very weird. We also welcome the Empire Reports.
I was going to say.
What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
I said it's just hard to work up the same enthusiasm.
It is. Well, save your enthusiasm for this show. We love it. JP Miller is here. He's from the Empire Report. Good morning, JP. How are you?
Joe, I'm great listening to the B-52s play Rome on the way in. That was awesome, and I'm very enthusiastic.
Well, you know, the reason we're playing the B-52s is we want to give a shout-out to our friends Kate Pearson, of course, of the B-52s, and her wife, Monica Coleman. They were featured in the New York Times on Sunday. They did a whole feature, and there was a question in there about give us an idea of your breakfast routine. And they went into this detail as to how they get ready in the morning, and they gave WAMC a great shout out that they listen to us every morning.
Wow.
So that's very nice.
Huge.
So we thought we would pay them back and thank them for their nice words. So we'll be hearing Kate and the B-52s this morning. It's
Joe,
lovely.
I can't tell you how many people wrote me letters.
I know. That's great.
And I'm sure the same for you. You're in the New York Times this morning.
That's right.
Amazing.
And they run this very cool place, Kate's Lazy Meadow, in the Hudson Valley. And it's just amazing. And we love them. And they're wonderful to us here at the station. And we've had Kate on many times. And it's just great. And Monica. And it's great to have them here in our region. And we thank them. So we'll be listening to B-52s. And there's no better music to get you excited and to talk about a Democratic National Convention that kicked off last night. It was the first night of the convention. We heard from Michelle Obama. We heard from John Kasich. We heard from Andrew Cuomo. We heard from Amy Klobuchar. And, well, the headline, of course, was Michelle Obama. And by most accounts, not all, but by most, she did great. She delivered she was expected to deliver a withering indictment of the president, and that is exactly what she did. One of her quotes that has been making the rounds this morning in the press: he has had more than enough time to prove that he can do the job, but he is clearly in over his head. He cannot meet this moment. He simply cannot be who we need him to be for us. It is what it is. Of course, that last line hearkening back to the president using those same words to describe the coronavirus death toll in the country. It was weird not having a crowd. It was weird to have it very quiet in that regard, but it was highly produced and had certainly had its moments. Alan, what do you think?
Well, of course, she was terrific. And, you know, I thought one of the points of connection she made with the American public was that I hate politics, she said. And I think a lot of people do. I think one of the things they admire so much about her is that she tells the truth as she sees it. I get it. So we all know that if she had wanted to run for vice president, it would have been hers for the asking. Biden has made it clear of his respect for her and everything else, but she didn't want that, and I don't blame her. But in any case, she is a great heroine to so many people in America.
There was a lot going on last night as far as the building the character of Joe Biden. Also, many Republicans were featured. I mentioned John Kasich. Many Republicans looking to provide this bridge to vote for Joe Biden. Rosemary Armeo, what did you think of it?
Well, you know, the print media is making a big deal about polls that show Biden ahead, but they worry, the pundits worry that this is not enthusiasm for Biden and Harris. It's antipathy to Trump, and I think that was on display last night, including Michelle Obama's speech. This was not about what Biden and Harris will do so much as we got to get him out of there. So I dispute the thinking that the enthusiasm has to be for Biden itself. I think it almost may be enough to get Trump out, although I have to admit, I thought that was Hillary too, and I was wrong. So you saw it last night, especially with Bernie and Kasich, I think, that they were saying, this guy is dangerous and we need to replace him.
JP,
how do you think how do you think Bernie did all in all, Rosemary?
Oh, the contrast with his performance in 4 years ago was remarkable. I thought he was quite moving, and it was kind of sad to me that this was his goodbye to presidential politics. I'd wanted that to come a long time ago, as you know, but now when I heard him last night, it was kind of sad. And I do think he sees the chance for a lot of his ideas to actually be put in place because the country is in such bad shape.
And the big difference between this time and last time is, last time he knew he was going to make another run at it. This time he knew he wasn't.
Right.
So why not do the right thing?
J.P. Miller.
I was excited to watch last night, and I was wondering, what is it going to be like to see a production? You know, would it be boring? What would it be like without a crowd? I thought I found it not boring. I found it, compelling to watch the whole time. An interesting point is that, the speeches in the past with a live broadcast, a lot of times those speeches would run on. Who would stop one of the politicians from going over, and then it would get backed up. So I thought that it was very concise, well done. And I also noted on Biden, it seemed like everybody that spoke had a personal story of some way that Joe Biden personally touched them throughout their lives. It wasn't just he's right on this issue or that issue. It was really more of a personal story. That each person, he called me sometime when this happened, and I think you'll see that throughout the week that Biden's likability is something that they're going to use, they're going to exploit, they're going to do everything they can to harness that for more votes for him.
I also go ahead.
I'm sorry. You make a good point there, JP. But I just want to make one note of caution to those people who make this continual comparison between Hillary and Biden. I mean, I think to some people, not to all, but to some people, Hillary was not an easy person to relate to, whereas Joe Biden is. And I think that this is not by mistake that so many people made reference to his his personal attraction to them and on all of those stories?
Well, again, if that is the strategy, I think it's a losing one, because the polling shows that people who don't know Trump still feel that he speaks to them, and they are voting to support him. Biden can't compete with that. He cannot.
I also like the fact that they use Biden. Usually the conventions for the first three nights are kind of like funerals, where you're just talking about the person and not actually seeing them. So it was nice to see him interact and have the forum on race, where he was in charge. He was talking to Mayor Lightfoot of Chicago, among others. And I thought that was very, very effective. Mike Spain.
Yeah, it was difficult to watch for me, because I tried to turn it on. I mean, I turned it on at 8 o'clock to watch some of the pregame show, you know, on different stations, the cable stations, and then stuck with it through 9 o'clock. And boy, I think 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock is probably the right amount for the typical viewer. Unless you're a political junkie, it's just too much. But it clearly, two things were going on. I think you guys have covered it well. You had making Joe Biden appear to be warm and likable and wonderful, and at the same time just trashing Trump. And you know, that's pretty normal. How did you feel without the crowd, without the visuals of all those people in wacky hats, the cheese hats from Wisconsin, and the flags, and the?
I was fine with that.
Yeah.
I was fine with that.
Me too.
I don't know. I miss some of it, the revelry of it. I mean, I as a reporter, I've covered three different conventions, and you know, they. It's an exciting thing that you can understand when you're there, how it revs people up. And it, you know, that was already on the wane in the last 20 years.
Right.
And now it's just made for TV, you know, kind of thing. And maybe this is the logical conclusion. I just wonder how they're going to get four nights out of it. I looked at the schedule. They have a lot of great speakers, but gee, four nights. It's going to be brutal.
I have to ask Rosemary, because I almost texted you last night, Rosemary, but two words, Eva Longoria.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's more than just an actress. She's been a potent political force in Democratic circles for a long time, but I didn't care for that. Better than the hats and the stupid tweeters, you know, the people blowing horns and all this. But no, it kind of was like soap operas. I didn't like it.
Now, see, I would have
turned it off, except it was sort of homework for this show.
Yeah.
Well, it was like an infomercial to me.
The real question to me is who's listening? In other words, and who's tuning in? Now, we do know certain basic laws, immutable laws of politics. You watch who you like, which is why Fox has so many listeners. People like Fox, and why CNN has certain listeners, and MSNBC has certain listeners. But I'm afraid that what's happening here is that without the glitterati, without that extra, you know, stuff to see, all these people marching around and doing their thing and voting, and that I have a feeling there'll be less turnout from some of the independents and some of the Republicans who might be watching, which is why the Democrats were smart to bring a bunch of Republicans on to give their talk.
Well, the Republicans will have the same problem in a week, right? I mean, they're going to have the same issue.
You're exactly right.
Yeah, JP.
Do we know if it's going to be Eva Longoria each night, or if they're going to bring out other celebrities?
I don't know.
To anchor other nights.
No, they have one for each night. Okay. And Thursday night, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Oh, now that'll be great. Now, I personally, unlike Rosemary, I thought Eva Longoria did a fantastic job last night. I felt in safe hands as she was guiding us through these various segments. And whoever said that it had an infomercial feel, it did. But I thought, like, I was ready to pick up the phone and buy it. Sure.
Call this number.
Yeah, that's right. I also thought there was a woman who did one of the one of the most effective pieces for me, which probably would have been more effective, and I know it would have been more effective had she been on a stage, is the young woman who talked about her father dying. And,
father dying. Yeah, I thought that was very powerful.
Very powerful, and putting it clearly in the hands of Donald Trump, because her dad voted for Trump and said, he's keeping me safe, he knows what's better, and then he passed away. And that was very, very powerful. Yeah.
Now, that was the obituary that the family published that got a lot of attention, isn't it? Is that at the same case? I think it was reprinted all across the country.
Yes.
She wrote all that right into the obit.
Yeah.
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 Her name is Kristen Urquiza, and she said his only pre-existing condition was trusting Donald Trump, and for that he paid with his life.
Yeah, it was very powerful. It was very strong, and that is a good example. I mean, I thought it was compelling watching it last night, but that is an example, I think, of something that would have been even more compelling had it been on a stage with thousands of people. But of course, we can't have that. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to the letters and we'll talk about this a little bit more. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller make up the gang this morning. We'll be back right after this. Every time I deeply listen to that song, I try to figure out what the hell it's about, and then I realize I don't care. I could just listen to it a million times in a row. It's so great. Welcome, and it's wonderful to have all of you with us. It is a Tuesday morning, August 18th, and we have Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller with us. A lot of people want to weigh in on the Democratic National Convention last night, so let us go to the letters. Robert writes, is Cuomo's 2024 campaign in full swing as evidenced last night? Well, that would indicate that Biden wouldn't win and maybe not run for re-election.
It might also mean he could win
and not run for re-election.
Right.
Yeah.
He's hinted that.
Yeah. He's already mentioned that possibility. I've asked Cuomo about this in my little conversations with him a number of times. And he has just poo-pooed it. Of course, you would expect nothing else, but that's been his attitude. I mean, I did specifically say that Senator Harris would be the nominal candidate, even if he doesn't step aside. If he does, so you know, the big problem here for Cuomo would be that he'll have to take her on. I think.
I thought Cuomo's speech was excellent. He obviously does really well live and off the cuff in those press conferences, and was wondering how he would do in a scripted setting. And I thought he really knocked the cover off the ball. He did really well, I thought. But the one thing that hasn't been really reported is that his speech was not on the network broadcasts. The first speech
right.
that was on the network broadcasts was Michigan Governor Whitmer. So, you know, while Cuomo was speaking on NBC, I flipped over NBC, they had American Ninja Warrior, which, you know, there are some people that would, you know, like American Ninja Warrior. But I thought it was interesting they didn't put him kind of in prime time like they did, Kasich and Whitmer and Bernie and Michelle.
Yeah, that is notable. I wonder how many people, I wonder how many people are watching the convention anyway. And then when you take those previous 2 hours or hour before when some stations are running it like PBS or MSNBC, you know, that really diminishes the audience. But then again, I do agree with you. Cuomo was very good. He was very polished. But I wonder how many people saw it. Of course, all of these pre-recorded canned speeches that were well edited and well written ahead of time will probably pop up in YouTube videos and ads and all kinds of things and memes that get sent across the internet. So it's not like they're just for the audience this week.
You know, Mike, I knew Mario pretty well, and I don't think his people would have ever permitted that to happen, down to the last detail. But Cuomo, of course, is pretty well known to all of America because of what he did every morning in his briefings.
And they played on that, and they had the bar graph there, and it was a little tongue-in-cheek, I think, and it was good. It was a good speech, and I thought it went well. This is just a note. I was amused that the speech itself took 2 or 3 minutes. The explanation of it during the briefing earlier in the day was about 25 minutes. But that was
unscripted.
That was unscripted. Yeah, that was the unexpurgated version, which we aired earlier in the day. Penny writes to us and says, I've never written before, but I had to today. I just wanted to say how good the convention was last night. So many aspects were inspiring, and I don't get inspired easily. The Republicans who spoke, the typical citizens who spoke, even the singing of the national anthem were all amazing. Michelle was so beautiful and powerful. I think they did an amazing job. Please be positive about this. We need to bring everyone together.
Yeah, the national anthem thing was really beautiful. I mean, it was well produced. It was a very well produced video montage for, you know, a couple hours. It's just, I don't know. I know, Rosemary, you don't miss some of the revelry, but hearing the crowd react to certain quotes during a convention does seem to add to my enjoyment. It's immediate barometer when, you know, Mike Bloomberg would say something about Trump or some, you know, or over the years you get different people saying things about the opponent. It just has... That's lost, and I feel bad about that.
Mike, you bring up Mike Bloomberg. I agree with you. What I thought was interesting, you know, all the former 2020 rivals, the people that ran for president and didn't win, had a really great montage telling stories of Joe Biden and all that. And I noted that both de Blasio and Bloomberg, who both, you know, I believe ran for president, both left out of that video. I think Bloomberg's going to have a primetime speech, but de Blasio... Not in the speech, not in the convention.
that's because that's right. his popularity is lower than a hound's belly.
Yeah, they even had Kirsten Gillibrand in that montage, but they kept Bernie out of it because he spoke last night.
Yeah, they didn't want to.
Bloomberg is scheduled to speak during the week.
Yeah. Edie wrote, where was Mayor Pete? Mayor Pete is a featured speaker on Thursday night, I believe. So they're saving.
Oh, right, but he was in a video.
What'd you say?
What do you mean even? What do you mean, even Kirsten Gillibrand? Why would she not be?
Oh, well, she did about as well on the, less than 1% as de Blasio did. She really didn't make much progress as a candidate, and she was on it. Yeah, that's all.
And yet they are trying very hard to be inclusive. That's for sure. They don't want to leave anybody out. They're not leaving anybody out in terms of the people who ran for president. And you got to respect the fact that they know what they're doing. Why should they alienate anybody except for de Blasio?
Right, right. Because Cuomo was on, and that kind of covers New York.
Right. All right. Let's go to Martha, who says, we are in mourning for the thousands of lives lost during the pandemic. On the slide of our democracy, balloons and old people in funny hats is not appropriate. Time to get serious. Pete says,
yeah, all that crowd response, that's what gave birth to Lock Her Up. I like to do away with all of it. Conventions are so, why do we have conventions anyway? We have primaries now.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it is a thing of the past, but there is, there is to me. I mean, so Trump, I mean, I know you're going to get into this later, Joe, but Trump is out barnstorming. He's showing up at airports and having smaller crowds, but crowds cheer him and yell four more years. And the Democrats don't have that. It's just a weird, weird kind of thing that doesn't feel right. And maybe the writer is exactly right to have, you know, some of the silly revelry that will go on at a convention probably is better not had this year. And that's a good point, too.
This might be the appropriate time to say that I had mentioned the other day that that there's now a CNN poll which shows only a 5-point difference between the candidates. We had many people write to me and say, and write to us and say, yeah, that's right, Alan, but the other polls are still showing 10 and 11 points. Joe, you do your magic. I know you do. And I don't have the slightest idea where we're at all of this.
Well, I mean, it went from 11 down to 9, didn't it? These are the long, meaningful interviews, they say, that gave it the 11, and that has dropped down to 9. But still, that's significant.
And most of the I think that CNN poll was a bit of an outlier because of the other polls that came out yesterday. The Washington Post ABC poll, I believe, I'll check that, I think had double digits. I think it was 11 points on that one going into the convention yesterday. So let's see. Pete says, I like the format much better than the usual Nuremberg rallies of roaring yahoos that interrupt the speeches every second or third phrase. It made the speeches sound like they were opinion pieces regarding the direction of the country. I don't need the mob mentality. I found it much more thoughtful. I listened to WAMC, by the way, so it was not influenced by the visual glitz either.
I'd like to, Joe, if I may, I'd like to speak to that for a second. I said it before, I want to raise it one more time, and that is, these conventions are not only for those of us who happen to feel one way or the other. I certainly agree with the letter writer. On the other hand, there are certainly going to be onlookers, people who haven't made up their mind, people who may be on the other side, who may be convinced by some of this. And that's why these conventions, the way they were, become much more important, is because they are circuses. There's no question about it. But what you want to do is get voters, not to convince people who are going to tune in and say, yeah, that's right.
Debbie writes, go ahead, JP.
Oh, yeah, I agree with Alan. It is a way for voters to hear directly from the candidate and the candidate supporters and not through the media lens. Now, I do think the media certainly tries to focus on the divisiveness, but I thought it was compelling. The first night of the convention, they have Bernie Sanders, who is the hero of the left, and John Kasich, who ran for president as a Republican 4 years ago on the same night, Kasich and Bernie.
Very conservative. Yeah. Can I just say one more thing about the crowd, though? Just go on YouTube and Google Mario Cuomo 1984 keynote address, Democratic Convention, and watch that. That is one of the most compelling speeches I ever watched, and was enthralled watching it on TV, but watching the crowd respond to him. I mean, I think there is something to be said for speaking and holding a crowd's attention and being effective.
Well, you also need a good orator, too.
Obama,
I know.
And Obama in 04, right?
Right. Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we'll talk more about this. We have many more letters to discuss as well. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Right.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A quick note that tonight the convention continues. The speakers are expected to include Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, former President Bill Clinton, and Jill Biden. And, of course, our coverage will begin at 9 o'clock tonight.
Joe?
Yes.
I did want to say one thing, and that is, I'm old enough to remember when conventions made decisions. These decisions are made by the time we get to conventions now. So that's why we have these canned, everything is planned in advance conventions. But I remember when I was 14 sitting there listening to whether John Kennedy was going to be nominated to be vice president of the United States, and it was quite a floor fight. So, and there I was in summer camp listening with my counselor. Those conventions really did make decisions, and therefore they were a lot more exciting, you know, in so many ways. And as somebody, one of my colleagues mentioned earlier, now we have primaries and most of it is all decided by the time we get there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I wish that I could get excited about it. I am a political junkie, and I had a hard time watching last night. It all seems to me really irrelevant. And also, I worry about the things that we're not paying attention to during these four nights while we're celebrating and pretending that we all love Joe Biden. Trump today just announced that he's going to pardon Susan B. Anthony. I'm sorry, I love that. I hate Trump. I hate everything he stands for, but that's a very cool move. And we're trying to beat him. Democrats are trying to beat him at his own game, especially now in these days when the conventions are produced and planned and they're branding.
Anybody else on that? All right. Gene writes and says, I cried, I clapped, I saw hope. I felt proud to be an American for the first time since November 2016. Wire says, my kids were able to watch it. Never would they watch a traditional convention. Loved it. And I love Kate Pearson. Rand says, Julian Castro was left out. Yes, he was. And that is weird. He has been critical. He has said that the Democrats should be very concerned about losing the Latino vote, even though AOC will be speaking tonight. Julian Castro was
not... 1 minute.
Yes, for 1 minute, exactly. And he was not asked to speak or to be one of the solo speakers. And he said a petition, he said that he was upset there was not enough time to demonstrate respect for the constituents that they represent. There's also been a petition and saying that I think there's only one Latin American who is speaking. So that is an issue and something that has come out in the early days of the convention.
One can only assume that there's negotiation going on before these decisions are made. One wants to be sure, if you're the Democratic Party anyway, that you don't have discordant voices. And I have a feeling we don't know the full story there. It doesn't sound like them to leave this very important person out.
Well, I was just going to say, at least, it's very different than the Republican convention, where you're not going to get people clamoring to get on the stage and say things that might be contradictory to the party theme. I mean, at least we know about Julian Castro and his own complaints about not enough Hispanic, Latino speakers, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and there's people who are opposed to Bloomberg speaking, and they've signed petitions and they want different people to speak in place of him. And there's a lot of dissent. And that is the Democratic Party. There's not much dissent over on the other side. You don't think you're going to hear, you might hear the Lincoln Project people make some comments, but you're not going to really hear much dissent. It's going to be pretty much Trump, 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 Trump all week long without any even outside criticism.
We go to Christine, who says, an amazing, uplifting event last night. Too bad the producers didn't figure out a way to have distanced watch parties on the side responding to the speaker. And then Christine also makes the note that Trump is stumping 2 days after his brother dies. Let's see. We go. Well, let's talk a little bit for a minute about the president. He was out and about yesterday. He made 3 campaign rally-like appearances at airports in Minnesota and Wisconsin. He's counter-programming to the Democratic National Convention. That certainly was the case yesterday. He questioned former Vice President Joe Biden's mental capabilities. He mocked Senator Kamala Harris of California as an extreme liberal in the appearances on Monday as Democrats began their 4-day political convention in Milwaukee. Standing in front of Air Force One in Wisconsin, a state that delivered 10 critical electoral votes for the president's 2016 victory over Hillary Clinton, Mr. Trump warned that the 2020 election was a fight for the survival of our nation and civilization itself. I don't think anyone on this program would disagree, and condemned Mr. Biden as a puppet of the radical left in the Democratic Party. You want to crush our economy, Mr. Trump asked the crowd at the Oshkosh Airport. Under the crazy socialist policies of sleepy Joe Biden and his boss, Kamala Harris, Kamala and his other boss, Nancy Pelosi, she's a beauty, and his ruler, Bernie Sanders, crazy Bernie, or do you want to quickly rebuild the strongest economy in the history of the world? Alan.
Rebuild the strongest economy, meaning we now have the weakest economy. You got a long way to go before you rebuild what you don't have. That's extraordinary. The other thing is, there's a certain amount, and I really love to hear Rosemary on this, of misogyny as he goes after the...
Oh, a certain amount, yeah. You're so right, Alan. That's what struck me about it, that it would be horrible to have a woman boss, and so he names Pelosi and Kamala Harris. Like, that's such a terrible thing. Can I point out that men who are strong enough and confident enough to work for and with strong women are the heroes of our civilization, not to be criticized. And his nicknames are so juvenile. He is so odious. It's hard for me to give a reasoned response to his comments. I just want to slap him.
Yeah, but it's important to know what he's doing and why he's doing it, right, Rosemary?
Yes, yes, Alan.
But you got to think. I mean, these are people, a few hundred people that show up at an airport in Oshkosh. And who are they? But they're only the people that love Trump and are already decided they're going to support him. Or why would they come out to Oshkosh to greet his plane? I mean, it's just the same thing. I mean, the Democrats are doing it on TV this week, and Trump is doing it on a stump, a small stump, I guess. And then next week it'll be reversed. It'll be interesting to see if Biden honors that tradition where the opponents kind of lay low during the opposition party's convention, because clearly Trump is not doing that.
Well, traditions are shot, so he ought to be out there everywhere.
Yeah.
Alan?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm just appalled when I see the Democrats not fighting hard enough. They've got to get out there, and they've got to fight as if their lives depend on it, because they do. Because the future, there is a president who is in the Russian pocket, and we hear virtually nothing about it. This is the time, because this state, this nation is now up for grabs. Either we're going to stay with a Democratic government, or we're going to allow basically a totalitarian fascist takeover. It's that simple.
JP?
I was not surprised that Trump was trying to do counter programming, but it is a long, as you guys have said, it is a long standing tradition to really focus on the convention. The media is focused on the convention, what people are saying there. This is one of the few times that Trump lighting his hair on fire is not going to get as much attention as it normally would. And this really is a huge milepost for the country and getting everybody's attention focused, saying the campaign is really starting now. Here's the Democratic convention. Here's the Republican convention. I am not a huge, you know, Super Bowl football fan or Olympic fan. This is my Olympics every 4 years. This, the three debates, and then the couple weeks before the election, it does not get any better than this for many political junkies.
But, JP, let's face it. This president, this guy, because I really have trouble with the word president, this guy, Trump, he has an ability to overturn norms. So when you say there's a long-standing norm, right, of leaving the other guys alone so they can make their case, he's not going to do that. He's anywhere from 5 to 11 points behind in the polls. He's going to do everything in his power to break another norm in order to get elected.
Well, I think when Trump does that, though, there are two parties to that. There is Trump lighting his hair on fire, and then there is the media taking the bait and reporting on that hair being lit on fire. And this week, I think the media is going to do a good job at focusing on the convention, focusing on what the candidate and the candidate supporters say, and not going to take the bait on the Trump tweets. You know, I think he probably tweeted 100 times yesterday, you know? And I don't think that the media is going to take the bait this week.
JP, it isn't one media. As we all know, we've said it 1,000 times. Believe me, Fox is not going to be following the prescription you just laid out.
You're probably right on that.
Let's go to just a couple of letters before we go to a break. Laurie says, I have to disagree with Rosemary. Trump's pardoning of Susan B. Anthony was blatant pandering, considering what he's doing to voting rights and women's rights at the moment. We go to Roger. No one is mentioning the other primary candidates that did not speak, Tulsi Gabbard and Marianne Williamson. Leslie says Steve Bullock, Michael Bennett, and Deval Patrick were missing too. Maybe not everyone was asked or available. Yeah, we are forgetting the fact that there were like 173 candidates running, so it's probably hard to get them all in.
That would have been the whole program last night.
Right, yeah. Debbie says that I watch the convention more than I typically do, and I like the new format. Okay, I'm an introvert and more of a thinker than a wild party goer, and my mind is already made up for Biden. I think this was a great way of doing it. We will pause there. We will take a break. We're going to go over to news with Ray Graff, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the Democratic National Convention as well as many other stories. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org.
I won't take a hit in the mosh pit. I don't ever sit front rows for losers. I won't ever pay to watch your band play. I need hairspray, groupies for doers.
Five minutes past 10 o'clock on this Tuesday morning, the 18th of August. We welcome you to write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. A couple letters here before we move on to other subjects. Mark writes, if Michelle Obama were the candidate, she would have won the election with her speech last night alone. Trump is disgusting, but he does not make an emotional connection with his base. Does anyone on the panel worry if Biden can make that emotional connection? Silence. Crickets.
Well, it's an interesting question, Joe. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, Biden has some emotion. We know that because of the relationship to the past son, to Beau. And I think people can relate to that. But I also think people have had enough. They want stability. And I think the one thing that Biden proved in the primaries and that he's proving now is that he has some stability that he can bring to this country, which desperately needs it with this clown up there doing the kinds of incredible and outrageous things that he does virtually every day. So I don't know that the question is properly put. I think there are an awful lot of people who admire Joe Biden because of his stability.
Well, I think that's also why you heard Michelle Obama say the word empathy a few times. And the contrast drawn with Trump was one of the points. I mean, that he has empathy, that he can, he'll give a phone number to someone who, you know, to a teenager that's lost a parent. You know, he'll give his personal phone number to them, and he whispers to people and says things, you know, and sometimes that has gotten him in trouble being a little too close to people. And that's not what I'm talking about, but I think that he is the antithesis of Trump in the way that he's warm and congenial that way, and Trump is more distant and has more difficulty being warm and expressing emotions.
Rosemary?
So I disagree with the premise of the question. I think that Michelle Obama enjoys great popularity because she is so apolitical. She repeatedly says she's not interested in politics, even while she's doing political things. If that were to change, if she were, for example, the vice presidential candidate, then we'd be hearing about how emotional she is. It's the catch-22 for women in politics. On the other hand, Joe Biden has managed to come off as a empathetic man, who he cries, he touches people, even to the point of touching too much. He does have a connection with people. So I think that he has no problem showing emotional attachment. He clearly loves politicking. He loves being in crowds. He is a good speaker. I think he actually can pull that part off. That's not his problem.
There's a letter. There's a letter, Rosemary. I'm only going to read the first sentence, which says, if the media isn't taking the bait, we wouldn't know Trump was in Wisconsin, and we wouldn't know anything he said when he was there. Norms are clearly not being honored. What do you think? This is the old trope.
Ridiculous. It's the president's job to protect norms. The media covers the president. That's all that we can do. I don't know if we spoke about this before, but do you remember the Axios reporter who said to the president, you feel bad about all those lies? And everybody applauded it. Oh, finally, he's speaking out. The media is, you know, not taking the bait. They're finally asking the question. I thought it was completely inappropriate.
It was a Huffington Post. Huffington Post journalist, actually.
I thought it was great. I thought it was
actually this was Jonathan Swan, but it was this was at the briefing, right?
Yeah. I thought it was terrific.
That was not the role of a journalist. The role of a journalist is to get information out of a reporter. After he asked that snarky little question, which I admit, you know, I felt a stab of satisfaction that he asked it, the president turned away and didn't answer him. So he didn't do his job.
Now,
He did do his job because he pointed out that the guy is a lying liar, as I always do. And the fact is,
you're not a journalist. Different.
Well, we'll get into that some other time about what the breadth of journalism is. You know, there was a guy around here in the old days, you know, I don't want to start that, but you can make that distinction. I don't make it. I think he was great to ask the question, and I think it brought something before the American people that they needed to hear again and again and again.
The reporter was on. I saw him being interviewed a few days ago, and he said, he was asked the question, what did you expect as an answer? And he said, I didn't expect him to answer. I didn't know if he was going to deflect it. I didn't know if he was going to yell at me. I didn't know what he was going to do.
That's awful. That's theater. That's not
okay.
And he's being interviewed. When do journalists become the story?
The reason he became the story is exactly because of, and I don't mean any disrespect to this, but for people like you who are upset that he did what he did. His clarification was this, which was that the story the story day in, day out is that Trump is lying to the American people. And he said no one has ever asked the question, do you ever feel remorse for lying to the people? And he said that is the story. That will be the story, 20,000 plus lies over and over and over and over again. And he said, and no one has ever asked him the question about the lying.
Couldn't agree more.
Now, I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that is what he said. That was his response.
But I do. I know it was right.
I've spent a career teaching reporters not to do that, not to ask snarky questions. In Eastern Europe, that's the way they interview everybody. You expect us to believe that. And that's what he did. It was really disconcerting. Talk about breaking traditions. I mean, I want us to return to some of the traditions of our democracy. And that journalist seemed to, he went along with the idea that the press can make comments about, I don't know. I've already said my piece on this.
The question, it was the Huffington Post senior White House correspondent, S.V. Date, and he asked the question, which was, do you regret at all lying to Americans? That was a question. Go ahead.
Well, why in the world would that not be appropriate? I think, it's gotten the kind of publicity it has because people believe it was the right question to ask. I mean, why do mumbly jumbly when you have a chance to get right to it?
But don't you see?
He didn't answer it, Alan. I mean, he raised the question and he didn't answer it.
He answered it in a different way.
If that's so important to hear Trump speak about that, you don't ask it in that way. Talk to anybody that way.
Mike, I have to agree with you, Rosemary. I mean, there's an appropriate way to ask that question. You can say the Washington Post has documented what it says is 20,000 examples where you have told lies. Do you ever... what's your answer on that? Asking him to respond to that, and when they do point out these contradictions, do you ever acknowledge it? And if you do, do you have any regrets about it? Those are more objective questions. It's like the way he asked it was a little more like, have you stopped beating your wife? You know?
Bob Humbug. Bob Humbug on all of you. The fact of the matter is...
Well, I mean, it is good theater. Yeah. I got to tell you that.
Well, it's not only good theater, it's relevant.
Exactly. I admit I felt a stab of like, whoa, cool. But it isn't cool.
But
yes, it is.
Journalism gets as broken as politics. That's not a good thing either.
But Rosemary, just to argue this out just for a minute, what you were saying earlier is that Trump is good at playing this game of going out and the pardoning of Susan B. Anthony and going out on the road and so forth, and that's theater too. But how many legitimate questions have been asked, and the president employs the theater by storming out of the press briefing without even answering it? Those are good questions that he's walking out on.
And he did, Joe. When he walked out, he was...
Has he really won by storming out, or has he not been shown to be troubled by them and cannot answer those questions? Don't have to ask in a snarky way.
I think by the fact that he did walk out or that he didn't answer the question, he answered the question. I think it's that simple.
Because in this case, he just moved on to a different reporter. Let's see, real quick. Marion says, can you say something nice about Bernie without making an insult about what he did 4 years ago? I disagree with Rosemary's assessment of 4 years ago, but it's neither here nor there. We need to all come together. Biden needs Bernie's voters. Every time Rosemary does this, it redoubles my resentment of the Democratic establishment. I need to move past it for our current emergency. Can she move past 2016 for our common cause? Constantly insulting Bernie at this point is just counterproductive.
Wait. I did compliment Bernie on
this
show.
This is Rosemary, though.
No, I know.
This is Rosemary. Rosemary constantly insults him and will continue to do so. I do still resent it. I think Bernie played a role, along with the Russians and Hillary not listening to Bill Clinton, in 4 years of tumult and hell for this country. So, yeah, I do have trouble putting it behind me.
Jano says, how many of the contributors do you think had pre-taped speeches? It's very different when you can pre-record and then press play versus really being live. Longoria was maybe the only one who was really live. Does that not create problems real-time versus staged and rehearsed?
I think so.
Well, Yeah, but I think it needs to be pointed out that all the conventions for the last 20, 30 years have had these video segments that go on. They play them on big screens in the convention hall. And most of the time, the network stations and the cable stations pretty much just run a little bit of it, and then they segue back to their own commentators and their own spin doctors talking about it. And the public doesn't see those quite as much. Now it's just more of it because that's the only way you can do it.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah, but when Mario got up there and he gave that incredible speech, that was not on tape. That was not on videotape.
Of course.
And the reaction of those people. So it's a matter of balance. You're absolutely right, Mike, but it's a matter of balance. You may want to do some promotional stuff, but there are crucial times you don't want to do that.
I thought, JP, that it was almost all taped until there was a screw-up with Jim Clyburn when he was talking. Where they had a miscue, and then I was wondering if that was live and inserted. I wasn't sure if they just mis-edited it.
Clyburn's looked live to me, and I agree that you're probably not going to get the historic Mario Cuomo speech or the Senator Barack Obama 2004 speech, but you're also avoiding gaffes. And if there, you know, when there is a gaffe in an otherwise, you know, great night, that tends to be what people focus on. I think about Al Gore, kissing his wife in 2000 as being something that the media focused on a lot. And I think it took away a lot from the actual real focus of what the night should have been.
Not to mention their marriage.
That was before they got divorced.
Right.
Tony writes, dearest Benno, I love not having the crowd cheer at every single line. I felt they were speaking directly to me. Kara says the key word from last night was decency. All right, let's go to the Postal Service and what's going on there. The Democrats plan an emergency hearing on Postal Service, what they're calling sabotage, as Republicans allege a conspiracy theory. The U.S. Postal Service remained gripped in a partisan battle Monday as Democrats pushed for an emergency hearing and funding, while the Republicans accused them of stoking a conspiracy theory ahead of a November election in which millions of votes will be cast by mail. The Postmaster General agreed to testify next week before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform about the sweeping operational changes that have led to mail delivery delays across the country and raise concerns among elected officials and voters. Louis DeJoy, a top donor and fundraiser for President Trump, who took the Postal Service position in June, has come under increasing criticism for the changes, which he has said would increase efficiency and reduce costs. Trump, who defended DeJoy, did not hesitate to opine on the partisan considerations that have shaped the debate over the Postal Service, adding to the sense that the battle over an iconic American institution had been reduced to a political fight for power. Alan?
Well, look, it's so clear what's happening here. Trump has been almost honest about it. He knows that the more people who vote, I've said it before, I'll say it again, the more people who vote, the better the Democrats' chances are. Because a lot of people will get their vote in because they can't do it otherwise, because they're working or they're flipping hamburgers doing this. So he doesn't want it to happen. So it's so clear. Destroy the post office. Now, the American people don't like it. And I guarantee you that Nancy Pelosi and her group are watching this, and they say, okay, we better do something about this, back to Washington, to make it clear you can't stop people from getting their medicines in the mail, and you can't stop us using the post office. And we know that this is a stupid, stupid move on your part, Mr. President, and we are going to shove it up your nose.
Rosemary?
Well, he can do it. He has done it. Those 700 mail sorting machines that have been taken offline cannot be put back on quickly. We know that from postal experts. We don't know why they were taken offline. How does that promote efficiency and economy? We do not know that. And so Congress's idea of oversight is to call an emergency meeting for for a week from now. That gives him what? He's had 10 days now to meet with lawyers and with speechwriters and with publicists to come up with a cover story. And the setup of those congressional hearings will allow Jim Jordan and all the other little clowns to defend what's going on and to paint Democrats as nuts to be worried about this. And we're going to still end up with the post office not being apparently in shape to handle ballots, which, by the way, I do not understand, since don't they do Christmas cards every year and get them all out on time? I don't understand what's going
and that's
on,
much
and I really have little hope that the congressional hearing is going to clear up anything. I think it's more meaningless theater.
Mike?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that when he was in Wisconsin yesterday, the president was urging people to get those absentee ballot applications in and get those votes in. And he himself is a absentee mail voter in Florida. I mean, the contrast, the doublespeak on that is so so obvious that it's got to be hurting him. He tweets yesterday, make the post office great again and save the post office. Did it need to be saved? Was it crumbling down, and how do you save it? By making it crumble down even faster? I mean, you know, exactly. I think it was a big mistake going after the post office, and the Democrats are playing it right. They gave LaJoy appropriate time to be there, and while the Republican convention is taking off, the Democrats are going to be making their own news about the post office, and it's become a very bad issue for him, and I think it's going to cost him, and it's only going to motivate people to apply immediately for the absentee ballots, and you know, the ones who are worried about Trump, and get that vote in as quickly as possible. And yes, Rosemary, they say that the mail from Christmas is like triple what a big turnout would be of mail balloting in November.
And yet at Christmas, nobody was throwing, a grenade into the post office. That's what he's doing now. That is so clear from everything we're hearing from the post office people and the way that they are talking about no overtime, no going back into the building. If you need something, anything they can do to put a stop to the safe and efficient functioning of the post office is what they're up to.
JP?
The first day of class in Alan Chartok's Political Science 101, he's going to tell all the students that Republicans win in low turnout elections and Democrats win in high turnout elections. So what is Trump trying to do? He's trying to sow distrust in mail-in voting and foment people's belief that their vote isn't going to get in. And so I actually think that it is going to hurt the Democrats if they're talking about, you know, for the last 2 weeks, all we've heard about is mail-in voting. We're not talking about over 100,000 COVID deaths. We're not talking about 11% unemployment in the country. We're not talking about health care. We're talking about mail-in voting. And I think what he's doing is going to probably be effective in sowing distrust in mail-in voting.
Alan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to get our minds off the things that, you know, another lie is, if we could just go back to before, the economy was doing so well before COVID, and now it's not. This is the same guy who said COVID wasn't coming here to this country, and that he was prepared, and that the country was prepared. Lie.
Were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to add that I think they effectively brought that up last night about COVID. I think JP makes an excellent point. When you think that the deaths are still hovering around 1,000 a day across America, that's like three packed jet airliners crashing and everybody dying every day, and yet it doesn't seem to be getting the attention that some kind of mass death like that would day after day after day would get. We've sort of become numb to it. And the Democrats were pointing out they were effectively, I think, dealing with the suggestion, hey, Trump didn't cause the COVID crisis. I mean, no, I'm sorry. Trump didn't cause the, COVID-19. He cannot be held responsible for that. but he can be held responsible for the very, very poor response. And that's where they're going to focus. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big issue you're going to hear more about this week. And I think it's going to be the one that turns the election.
How many people died at 9/11? Do we know?
3,600 was it in the U.S.?
3,000.
Yeah.
So think 3,000. About that.
Under 3,000.
So think about that. Now all these people, tens and tens and tens of thousands of people, are dying. They don't have names. The interesting thing about the Democratic Convention is they know that. They know that numbers are not saleable. So what they're doing is they're bringing people on who are telling stories of their own, of a single person who has really been hurt or died as a result of it. And I think that's brilliant.
Let us talk for just a moment before we go to the break about the Postmaster General, who is under fire for his business ties and his cost-cutting measures. Here is a guy who, they say, earned millions from his company with financial ties to the Postal Service. He's continued the company that does business with the Postal Service, received $1.2 million to $7 million in income last year from that firm, according to financial disclosure forms reviewed by the New York Times. Mr. DeJoy continues to hold $25 million to $50 million in that company, XPO Logistics, where he served as the chief executive until 2015 and was a board member until 2018. Documents filed with the government Office of Government Ethics show that Mr. DeJoy also received millions of dollars in rental payments from XPO through leasing agreements at buildings that he owns. The revelations are likely to further fuel scrutiny of Mr. DeJoy, a major donor to President Trump, who has made a series of cost-cutting moves and other changes to the post office the Democrats warn are aimed at undermining the 2020 election, which we have mentioned. Rosemary, how much should we bring up these financial connections?
I'm just sitting here listening to this, thinking what a fabulous job that Senate committee did in confirming this guy. We do a terrible job vetting, especially Trump candidates for the judiciary and high posts like this. I think we should pay a lot of attention to it. This is another one of the corrupt, terrible businessmen that Trump has tried to bring into the cabinet. And we continue to just go through them. They do a tremendous amount of damage and at no penalty. I'm still waiting for his first Secretary of the Interior to be indicted. It's been 2 years.
Mm. Mike?
You know, I do think that the revelations about the conflicts with LaJoy will come up during the congressional hearings next week, and it will dog them. And I think that I disagree with the notion that Trump is winning on this post office thing. As I said before, I think it has already backfired on him and has motivated people and states to come up with other ways to take in the ballots. You know, the ballot box thing has been legal and tested across the country, and now Trump is fighting that, and that's bad optics for him to fight that in Pennsylvania. I think this is a losing issue for Trump, and he ought to really kind of let this post office thing go away and try to go at it and, you know, take credit for the economy. And because polls show that even now, 10% more think that he's better for the economy. He can better manage the economy than they think Biden can. And that's the area that ultimately is what would get him reelected if he's going to be reelected.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable, our last go-around on our panel. This morning, we have Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to another story here, and we will talk about the University of North Carolina. It's an interesting story because it's hard to read and not think of what will happen in other college towns across the country. UNC Chapel Hill pivots to remote teaching after coronavirus spreads among students during the first week of classes. University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is one of the largest schools in the country to bring students to campus for in-person teaching. On Monday, it said that it will pivot to all remote instruction for undergraduates after testing showed a pattern of rapid spread of the novel coronavirus. The shift signaled enormous challenges ahead for those in higher education who are pushing for professors and students to be able to meet on campus. Officials announced the abrupt change just a week after classes began at the 30,000 student state flagship university. 177 cases of the pathogen had been confirmed among students. Out of hundreds tested, another 349 students were in quarantine on and off campus because of possible exposure to the virus. The remote teaching order for undergraduate classes will take effect tomorrow, and the university will take steps to allow students to leave campus housing without financial penalty. The actions are likely to reverberate in North Carolina and beyond, including other major public universities that have hopes of playing college football in the fall. UNC Chapel Hill's Tar Heels teams play in the Atlantic Coast Conference. Oi, Alan.
Okay, everybody, do this for me. Put yourself in the president's chair of any university or basically any high school or any, you know, K through 12, and say to yourself, what would you do? Would you get sued? Would you say it's irresponsible to bring people back into this campus if in fact, 100 people have it and then everybody else is going to get it? There's no question you've got to call off the classes. It's not preferable. We don't want to do our education that way. I hate it. On the other hand, I think that's what you have to do.
Rosemary?
Yeah, you have to wonder at the decision to open school in North Carolina, which has a high rate of transmission at this point, why that was done in the first place. It's like opening the state of Georgia before things are under control. The science is there. Dr. Fauci, Alan's hero, has said all along you can't open big facilities and institutions in these kind of situations, and they did it, and now they're paying a price. It's far more chaotic and expensive to have opened one way and now have to make the pivot. That said, I'm very happy that they are making the pivot because there's a lot of sick students, and the chance of spreading that was high, and probably so was the temptation to just say, oh, it's not that bad. So it was... it's good that they moved it. I'm very glad that UAlbany made a much more careful decision about how they were going to do things, and they are also monitoring. My classes are online, and I'm really, really happy about that, even though I don't like teaching online. I love being in front of students, but we're in the middle of a health crisis. Could we please act like that?
What would you do, Rosemary, if they said to you, go in and, teach your class live? Would you feel, as many unions have been saying and many teachers on all levels have been saying, I don't want to go and risk my life and that of my family? What would you do?
Yeah, I mean, they are projecting that there will be a huge loss of teachers nationwide because of this. I think you're making life and death decisions. I would be sitting there deciding, okay, do I put my elderly mother with whom I live at risk, or do I risk my job? In my case, of course, it's not a good example because I don't have to have that money to live on, but many people do. My son is a teacher. If he were forced to go into school in Virginia, would he then bring it home and threaten me and his grandmother? You know, those are not decisions that you should have to make in order to keep a job.
But if I'm teaching this semester. I have two classes, and I'm going to be teaching some in person. And I don't do at what point I'm not saying this is right. I'm just asking the question. It is, what point do you have to trust, or should you trust, or can you trust the wording and the all that has been done to try to keep students and teachers safe in the colleges so that your classes are only 12 students at a time, they're cleaning the rooms, everyone's wearing a mask, and what at what point do we say, okay, we're going to trust that all of the planning and all of the meetings and all of the talk back and forth, and let's face it, even the governor's guidelines in the state of New York have said this is safe. Do you trust that?
Well, in New York, I don't have as much problem as if I were a teacher in, say, Georgia. I would not believe anything that came from that state government or Arizona, for example. So that's part of it. Monitoring is part of it, which is why I'm so happy to see what happened in North Carolina. They made the wrong decision, and now they backed away from it, which is what they should be doing. That's right. So that's kind of encouraging. You know, the one other thing to go into this is the efficacy of the teaching. I've taught online for many years. It does not work with every student. You have to be extremely motivated, very disciplined. It is different learning online than it is in person, and it's not for everyone. So when you're forced to use it with everyone, that means you're not getting the same education. You are not getting the best that you could. That comes from the in-person interaction with teachers and with other classmates. So
Rosemary,
there's a lot that goes into this.
What's the alternative?
Yes.
The alternative is possibly death. I mean, yes, we all understand we don't want to give stuff up, but think of the alternative to not doing the right thing. North Carolina didn't do the right thing, and all these kids are getting infected.
Well, a statistic I always thought that was interesting that Governor Cuomo cited a number of times during his press conferences was that the infection rate among essential emergency workers was lower than the infection rate of the general public. And Cuomo would constantly say, why is that? It's because they took precautions seriously. They wore the mask, they wore the right gear, they took the right precautions. And that's why, you know, nurses throughout the pandemic, nurses, police, grocery store workers, transit employees, they were all going to work every day. They're essential workers. And I think many people like Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio look at teachers and say, teachers are essential workers too.
Well, I think what you're saying, JP, at least what I'm hearing, is that there's a right way to do things and there's a wrong way to do things. And it'll be very interesting to see what the small colleges, a lot of colleges in upstate New York are already accepting students back. Some have to go through quarantines once they get there. But they're going to allow this limited kind of controlled situation. And if it's done right, it probably will be okay. The problem is there could be an off-campus party some weekend and mess the whole thing all up, and they might have to shut the school down.
Right.
I mean, I think it's worth trying to do in a manageable way when you have 30,000 students, like some of these colleges, these major university centers have. It's very different. It's very difficult to enforce the rules and to get the message across. And, you know, yes, North Carolina, University of North Carolina did the right thing. They tried to do what they thought was correct, discovered very quickly it was not going to work, and they made a very, very painful, difficult decision to do the right thing and end it. But I don't think it's necessarily the wrong thing for a small college in a controlled situation that has planned it out and is in a state that has a very, very low infection rate because of the disciplined approach that the state took to it, like New York, that it's the wrong thing. It's just, there's so many personal decisions. Like, professors have to weigh whether it's going to risk them or their families. Even students who might have compromised situations have to make decisions. And then we haven't even touched the whole issue of, is paying full tuition for essentially a Zoom education really fair?
Good point.
Well, it's a good point, but none of it is fair. Nothing
That's
here
right,
is fair. Nothing
yeah.
here is fair. You know.
Absolutely.
Think about it. And think about all of the lists that just came out from this economist at NYU who named all of these colleges he thought were at financial risk of closing. And on his list were things like Bard, Skidmore. I don't believe it, by the way, but they were. They were on the list. And now they get faced with, if we don't bring them back, we're in even worse shape. Of course, if we do bring them back and we get sued, we're in terrible shape also.
Well, the other thing, too, is just the cynicism that I think many of us have, which is, okay, well, we'll go back, but how long is this going to last? You know, all right, we'll go back, but you know, if this much like North Carolina, well, okay, last a week, and then you turn around, you go back to. I think that's a case too, and that has proved itself to be true many times, except with baseball, where I think 2 or 3 weeks ago we were all saying, well, the season will be over by the weekend, and we're still playing, so who knows. Should mention that the President Trump tweeted a few moments ago about Governor Cuomo and his speech last night. A horrible governor. Crime is taking over New York City and state. Everyone is leaving. He is after the NRA. They should move to Texas or elsewhere and must get tough. Cuomo killed 11,000 people in nursing homes alone. Crooked and incompetent.
Oh, my goodness.
That is the...
I'm with Rosemary on that.
Well, ad hominem attacks are what he does well.
No, he's also a liar. What'd you say, Rosemary?
This guy. I just said he's odious, you know, and public opinion is against him. His put his ratings from the public on performance during the virus between Cuomo and Trump, and you have the reason for that vitriol.
Yes. All right, we are just about out of time, and I think we only have about a minute. So let me just thank everybody for being with us, and we, of course, will be talking much more about the convention tomorrow as well. We will be covering having the NPR coverage of the Democratic National Convention Night 2 tonight, beginning at 9 p.m. Alan, thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Joe.
Also, Mike and Rosemary and JP, thank you so much.